from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The election is now just 4 days away, and this morning on Forum, we'll wrap up our pre-election coverage with one more go-around about what's at stake. The contours of the election have been clear for a while. Deep dissatisfaction with Congress and incumbent office holders at almost every level. What remains to be seen is whether the so-called wave election will be a tsunami that swamps the Democrats or whether there are a few surprises lurking out there in the muddy waters of campaign 2010. In the hour ahead, we'll break down where the key races stand at this hour, both here in California and around the country. The final days of the campaign, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The new field poll out this morning shows Barbara Boxer with an 8-point lead over her Republican challenger, Carly Fiorina. It's a race that will not only determine who represents California in the United States Senate, of course, but may have everything to do with who controls the Senate itself. As the campaign enters its final days, we're going to take one more look at what's going on with voters this year and why. Will Republicans sweep back into power on Capitol Hill? What are the key races to watch election night, both here in California and nationwide? And can anything help Democrats short of donning orange and black and a Brian Wilson beard? Joining us for our final election preview, Chris Lehane, who I should note is dressed in orange and black this morning. He's a Democratic consultant and partner at Fabiani and Lehane, spent 6 years in the Clinton White House, and was Vice President Al Gore's press secretary throughout 2000. Chris, good morning.
Thanks. It's always an honor to be here.
Happy to have you join us. Mark Baerbeck joins us as well. He is the national political correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Hi, gentlemen.
And John Fortier joins us, too. He is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, writes frequently about campaigns for Politico, and is also the executive director of AEI's Continuity of Government Commission. John Fortier, thanks for joining us, too.
Thank you for having me.
Happy to have all of you here. It's tempting at this point in the campaign to talk about where things, not so much even where things are, Chris Lehane, but why things have turned out the way they have. Yesterday, the San Francisco Chronicle had a headline which even put the Whitman campaign in past tense. It said she didn't make the sale. So without going so far already into what the conclusions are of this race, what do you think people ought to actually be thinking about in the present tense as they approach the election?
Well, I mean, you do make a good point about political obituaries almost being written before the campaign has even taken place. You know, to me, the one lesson that continues to burn through with me is the enormous voter anxiety that exists out there. I think over the last decade, we've had an era of roller coaster politics in this country where almost every 2 years we have what people would call a wave election. And historically, you hadn't had those types of wave elections in as compressed a time period as we've had in recent memory. And I really do think it's ultimately a reflection of the fact that there is enormous anxiety. People understand there's structural challenges to our economy. And I don't think people have been particularly happy with either party fundamentally addressing some of that anxiety. You know, who's going to be out there really fighting so that the American dream exists in the future? Look, I think Obama was dealt a very challenging card, right? An economy headed towards the next Great Depression, two wars. You get the flu, the swine flu thrown on top of that. And I think day in and day out, he's done a pretty effective job actually managing government. I think his big challenge is that he's yet to really make a theory of the case as to his presidency with American people. But look, his big challenge and the reason why this is going to be a tough election for Democrats fundamentally comes down to the economy and people not being happy with the direction of the country.
Chris Lehane, Democratic consultant. John Fortier, pick up on that point about impatience and that we now seem to be in this cycle where people want to throw the rascals out every 2 years. I'm curious about your view in that in part because of the position you hold at the American Enterprise Institute as executive director of AEI's Continuity of Government Commission, which I have to say almost sounds like an oxymoron these days. We don't seem to believe in continuity of government.
Well, I don't want to get too much into that subject because actually what we mean by that is things after 9/11, you know, very bad things happening to the government and are trying to come back. So that's sort of another hat that I wear. But I think Chris is right that we've seen a lot of shifts back and forth. You know, first a very big swing in 2006 and 2008 to Democrats, and what we expect to be a similarly big swing back to Republicans this year. But I wouldn't say it's generalized anxiety. I mean, I think they're about different issues. We certainly people lost confidence in George Bush, and some of that had to do, I think, especially with the Iraq War. The economy wasn't so bad at the time in 2005 when they really started to lose confidence in him. But today, Chris is right. The economy is one bad hand that the Obama administration has been dealt. But there is a second issue, and that's an ideological one where Republicans and the Tea Party and some moderates have united around the idea that, you know, we're worried about big government, we're worried about deficits and debt, and some of it, you know, again, may have been made much easier for the Obama administration had we had a better economy. The programs would have looked cheaper, the deficits would have looked smaller, but with all power concentrated in Democratic hands, with a bad economy, and with, you know, an aggressive president trying to move the country in a direction that he believes in, this unified an opposition, which is not only the Tea Party, but also, I think, encompasses some moderate and independent voters who are a little bit worried about the direction we're going in.
John Forte, research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Mark Baerbock, as you've been out covering various campaigns around the country, what are you seeing? You wrote a story recently for the LA Times about the race for the Senate in Pennsylvania in particular, where there's this sense that people seem to want the middle, but that isn't necessarily, especially in Pennsylvania, what the two Senate candidates represent.
No, and, you know, the whole point of that story was we kept hearing so much about angry voters, angry, 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 and it's the yelling and the screaming and the carrying on cable news that gets all the attention in the headlines. But, you know, if you look at polls and if you talk to people, as I have around the country, not just in Pennsylvania, what you hear is this sense of anxiety and overwhelmingly this feeling that politicians of both parties aren't talking about the stuff people care about. You know, there's an anxiety out there. There are people who are jobless. There are people who have jobs that are worried about keeping them. And there's a feeling that, frankly, the political system is just not speaking to these people. Like I said, both parties. This is not necessarily a ratification of Republican policy, as I see it, so much as a repudiation of the party in power. People don't like either party. They're anxious, they're unhappy, and the bottom line, they don't feel like either party is talking to the stuff they care about.
Well, let's think then about what people really ought to be asking themselves. In California, Chris, of course, many people have already voted. Over half of all votes in California now exist, take place by way of mail. But for those who have not yet voted, and understanding that you're going to come at this from a Democratic perspective, and I'll get a somewhat different point of view from John Forte in a moment, but what should you ask yourself right now? Is it what kind of government you want? Is it whether or not you believe compromise counts? Is it what are the things that really ought to push you into making your final choices?
Well, you know, from my perspective, and obviously with the biases in terms of my political ideological view, you know, I think there's two things if I'm a voter that I'm looking for. You know, first, I'm looking for someone who I think is going to be a fighter for me and my family, who's going to stand up for my values. And then secondly, and to me, this is the key to political success in this country, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, but, you know, which official out there, which candidate out there is really going to be a steward for the middle class, is going to stand up for economic issues that ultimately matter to the middle class. Because that's always the key, particularly for Democrats to be able to successfully govern. I mean, Bill Clinton, who I worked for, was able to do an awful lot for historically disadvantaged parts of society, but he was able to do that because the middle class thought he was a fighter for them and a steward for their issues.
And in a sense, has that been President Obama's biggest flaw or biggest problem, is that he does not, in the way that Bill Clinton once did, make that connection with those middle class voters?
Yeah, as I said earlier, look, I think he's dealt an extremely challenging hand, and day in and day out has done a very good job of actually running government. I think the challenge that he has faced is that he has yet really to provide the country an overarching perspective, viewpoint, theory of the case, thesis, whatever you want to call it, about where he's taking the country that ultimately does connect and resonate with the middle class, is that he is someone who's going to be in the trench fighting for them, fighting for their jobs, fighting to make sure that America wins the jobs of the 21st century, but particularly being a steward for the middle class. And again, I think that he has actually done some of that stuff. I'm just not sure it has necessarily connected with those folks.
John Forte, from your perspective, what should voters be thinking about as they go to cast their ballot?
Well, I do think, fairly or unfairly, a midterm election really is a referendum on the president. And Democrats don't want to hear that this year, but, you know, Republicans didn't want to hear that in 2008. There's no person on the ballot on the Republican side of the president's stature. There are lots of congressional races, and voters often use these elections to send the message to say, hey, we at least if we don't want you to go in a different direction, we want you to slow down and stop. And I think especially on the question of you know, increasing the size of government or doing larger structural things that the Democrats want to do, healthcare being one accomplishment that the Obama administration did, but also just thinking about even though Republicans had some years where they were not the most fiscally prudent, they certainly are on board to be so now. And I think that's the strong message they're going to send. Slow down a bit. Consider debt deficits and the size of government. Don't go too far in that direction. And look, 2012 is going to be a very different type of election. It's a presidential election where Republicans will have to have a candidate with a much more positive vision. There'll be two visions set before us. But for a midterm election, I think a lot of Republicans are going to go and say, look, let's send a message. And a lot of independent voters are going to do the same thing. Let's send a message to slow down and not move in the same direction we've been moving, or at least not move as fast.
Mark Baerbeck, is that what you've heard from voters, too, this message of slowing down? And give us, if you can, any insight into where that came from as a kind of counterpoint to why people voted for Obama just 2 years ago.
Well, I think, first of all, someone said to me early this year, it was a Democratic strategist, and he offered to me the single most succinct analysis I've heard all year from anybody. And that was basically this: when you're in charge and things suck, you're going to pay a price. So I think that kind of sums it up. Having said that, I think there is, you know, as John talked about, I mean, President Obama, for good or bad, and I'm not taking sides, has done big things. He's done expansive things. He's expanded hugely the size, the scope of the federal government, the stimulus, the auto bailouts, Wall Street, all that sort of stuff. And there's a natural reaction. It's like a law of physics. Every, you know, action, opposite and equal reaction. And so there's a huge reaction to that. There is a feeling that the government has done all these things. The healthcare thing has frightened a lot of people. This is nothing new, you know, in our history. If you want to go back, there's always this tension between people who want a big and expansive federal government and those who don't. And those who don't right now are the ones that are pushing back against all this. And you know, what I hear from voters is, again, concern about the economy, about their jobs. One thing that I hear over and over from voters all over the country has been this feeling that, you know, the auto companies got their bailout. You know, Wall Street got their bailout. Fill in the blank. Everyone is getting help, but not me. That's a big thing that I keep hearing over and over.
Mark Baerbeck, national political correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, joining us this hour, along with Chris Lehane, Democratic consultant, and John Fortier, research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. John Fortier, back to this notion for a moment of people wanting somehow to, can't we all get along, you know, that old line. In the New York Times CBS poll that came out the other day, something like three-fourths of those polled said they wanted people to compromise. And yet, we're not likely to get that, are we? It was very striking to hear Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, say the other day that, quote, the single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president. Our biggest goal is to give our nominee for president maximum opportunity to be successful. If that's the goal, that doesn't sound a whole lot like a message that's oriented towards getting things done or towards compromise.
I'm pessimistic about compromise. As a political scientist, I can point you to history that says divided government isn't always bad for getting things done. There are examples. In fact, President Clinton and the Republican majority that came in with Newt Gingrich found some issues to work together on some common ground. But I don't see the situation like that today. We're going to be starting the 2012 election almost all as soon as we end this election. The Republican candidates will be declaring and debating, and Republicans will have had a significant win and won't be looking for small compromises or working with the president. Similarly, I'm skeptical of what the president is going to say. I think the biggest question, and Democrats, I think, are not quite prepared for this yet, is, you know, how do you answer the question, what was this election about? Did you get the message of this election? You know, Bill Clinton was pretty effective about it. It took a while. He was certainly down for quite a while, but he came back and talked about the era of big government being over. He moved to the middle in some ways, changed some personnel, but then found a way to fight the Republicans pretty successfully on the government shutdown. So we had a kind of mixed strategy and was quite nimble. So I give Chris credit to his old boss. Will Obama do the same thing? Will he have a kind of message that says, I got the election, I'm changing in some ways, but also find some issues to fight back on Republicans on. I'm not sure we're going to have much common ground. I think we're going to have big fights over the Bush tax cuts. We're going to have big fights over the budget and size of government. And I'm not sure we're going to do much more, and we're going to be looking for that election in 2012 to resolve this conflict in one direction or the other.
John Fortier of the American Enterprise Institute. Chris Lahane, give us some insight into what happened after the 94 election in the Clinton White House, because as John commented and others have commented, in some ways there's opportunity when you lose control of Congress. Some people have said that actually could be a good thing for Obama. What happened in 1994? Are there lessons in that for Obama in 2010?
You know, I always think there are lessons in history. Sometimes I think that you can misapply those lessons. Taking us back a little bit, I remember shortly after the election in 94, President Clinton was out there almost plaintively saying that I'm still relevant. And then, you know, over the period of about 6 or 8 months, you know, he really staged a comeback. Now, I think there were a couple dynamics in place there that were somewhat unique or allowed him to do it. You know, one, you had the terrible, terrible tragedy of Oklahoma City, and no one is suggesting that that was in any remotely way a positive thing, but it gave Clinton an opportunity to sort of reconnect with the American people. You had, secondly, an economy that came roaring back. I mean, the greatest economic time period, you know, in modern American history, if not all of American history, which gave an enormous platform to really mount that comeback. And then third, you had the Republicans engage in the government shutdown, which effectively gave President Clinton a moral high ground, at least a political moral high ground. And from that point on, he was able to engage in what people have on the outside called, you know, triangulation. Inside, I think we call it common sense, smart politics, and delivering for the middle class. But those dynamics, you know, allowed him and look, he made some of his you know, he took advantage of those situations and he made some of those situations come about. I'm not sure if some of those exact dynamics will necessarily be in place this time around. The economy, you know, is at a tepid level, 2% growth today, according to the most recent numbers. To even see it getting to 7 or 7.5% unemployment by 2012 is going to take some significant steps. So I don't think you're going to necessarily have a strong economy coming back. Do I think that the president has the potential to be able to position him as the guy who's going to fight for the middle class against Republican obstructionism? Yes, I think there is the potential to do it. I think he's going to have to be deft, and I think he's going to have to be skilled about that. But ultimately, it's going to require, I think, taking a step back, giving people the predicate about what is his government about, what is his philosophical approach to government about, and then using that basically as your basis to move forward. But I think until he does that, it's going to be difficult to really be able to position things going forward. Now, I'll just make two other quick points. One, 2012 is going to be to a large degree determined by who the Republicans put up. I mean, you look at all these polling data out there and people say, well, you know, Obama's not doing as well as with white males as he did in 2008. Well, that's all well and good for right now in the midterm, and John's absolutely right. A midterm is a referendum on the president. Question is, who are you running against in 2012? And a lot of those things, you know, need to be played out. I think the third element to look at, and you know, you've heard chatter about this, and I think you'll continue to hear chatter about this, is that on the other side of this election, where I think there will be paralysis, and I think the country will still be very anxious about where we're going economically, I think you're going to see more and more talk about structurally, does a two-party system work in this particular time in American history? Putting aside the fact that electorally it's very difficult to actually have a real third party, but I do think that there will be a continuing discussion about does this system work in today's world, given the fact that everything immediately becomes polarized and we do live in this world, as John pointed out, of perpetual campaigns, which I think undermine your ability to address some core issues.
Mark Baerbeck, and as you've been out covering various races, are you sensing that, a dissatisfaction with the two-party system? Are we at a time where we might see, not exactly, of course, what happened in Great Britain, but the growth of a significant alternative to the Republicans and Democrats?
You know, I'm fairly skeptical of that. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time, and the whole time I've been doing it, there's always that talk about third parties, and there's always dissatisfaction. In fact, I call it the Peggy Lee phenomenon. I mean, I'm not that old, but I know who Peggy Lee is. And, you know, people will look over the field, and I've said, you know, you could have Jesus running against Moses, and people will say, you know, is that all there is? I mean, are these the only choices? I mean, people always like choices. They want, you know, McDonald's and Wendy's and Burger King and Jack, all those things. So there's always this talk about the third party. I think structurally, as Chris alluded to, it's really, really difficult to see. You know, there are ballot laws which are in place by legislators of the Democratic and Republican parties who don't make it easy for third parties to get on the ballot. There's huge impediments in terms of fundraising, that sort of thing. And the simple fact is, you know, as much as people talk about they don't like parties this, they don't like party that, the single best marker for how someone's going to vote is whether they have an R or a D next to their name.
Hmm. We're going to be coming up on a break in a few moments, but let's talk a little bit about what's going to happen on November the 2nd. As I said at the beginning of the program, there's always this temptation at this point to sort of say it's all set, that the die has already been cast. But what are you going to be watching for, Mark Baerbach? We've mentioned Pennsylvania. You've also covered the Senate race in Nevada. What election night is going to be indicative to you of which way the country is shifting?
Well, we need to do this moving from east to west, obviously, because the polls are going to shut down there. In fact, those of us on the West Coast, unlike John, who's going to be sitting his office at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, you know, by 4 or by 5, we're going to have a pretty good sense here on the West Coast what's going on. A couple things I would look at in terms of the Senate. I would look at Connecticut and West Virginia. Those are a couple races that look like they're slipping away from Republicans. They need to win in those places. If they cannot win, if Republicans don't win West Virginia and they don't win Pennsylvania, which it looks like they could, then and it's going to be really, really tough to see how they get to 10 seats they need to take over the Senate. You know, in the House, I would look at there are some competitive races in Virginia. There are races that Republicans should win in Indiana. If they scoop up a whole bunch of seats in Indiana, if they scoop up a whole bunch of seats in particular in Ohio, they could pick up as many as a half dozen seats. If they win all the seats that they have in play in Ohio, then it's going to be a Democratic bloodbath that night. So look at Virginia, look at Ohio. Joe Sestak, the fellow who's the Democrat running in Pennsylvania. His seat is an open seat in Pennsylvania, very competitive. If Democrats hang on to that seat, it means they could do somewhat better than people expect if they lose that. And you see a bunch of Democrats going down in Virginia, in Indiana, in Ohio. It's going to be a really, really ugly night for Democrats and a happy one for Republicans.
John 48, what are you going to be keeping your eye on election night?
You know, I'm gonna look at this regionally as well. If I followed the Great Lakes states, if I started in upstate New York and went all the way through, and maybe not so much Minnesota, but all the other states, you're going to look at least two good chances, if not three, four, or five good chances for Republicans to pick up House seats in several of those states. How many seats they get in that region, I think, is something to watch. In the Senate, I'm looking at West Virginia. I agree. I think that's slipping a little bit away from Republicans. Still a close race, Illinois, Nevada. Colorado also on the radar screen. And out in your part of the country, I think Republicans are looking a little bit more to Washington State than California today with the polls. Both are, I think, a little bit out of reach, but if Republicans do sweep those other states, and then they'll be looking, I think, at Washington State for a possible chance at getting a majority, which I think is not that likely. Also, I think you'll just see lots and lots of governorships, lots and lots of state legislative seats go in the Republican direction. And one more thing I might watch is some of the Democrats, especially older Democrats, who've been holding conservative seats for a while. There aren't so many of them left, but there is a block in North Carolina and Virginia that we didn't think had any chance of losing a few weeks ago. And if you see 4, 5, 6 of those type of seats go in the Republican direction, then you're looking at a larger wave than we're expecting.
And Chris, just a brief snapshot from you before we go to our break.
Yeah, I think many of the districts and states they pointed out, in particular West Virginia on the Senate side and Illinois, because I think the Illinois one will just be inherently interesting in terms of the congressional.
Barack Obama's old seat.
Yes, and in terms of the House, I think you're looking at the 5th district in Virginia, probably the 15th, 16th, 17th in Ohio. And out here, even in the House, looking at the McNerney seat, which is in this general area, those are some to keep an eye on. But even below that, what I'm really going to be looking at, to the extent that you can get real data, is what the turnout information looks like. You know, there's a variety of polls out the last couple of days with wildly disparate suggestions on what the Republican turnout will be versus Democratic. And what that spread is will tell you an awful lot.
We'll come back in just a moment, talk more about where things will go on the night of November the 2nd and where we will go from there when we come back. If you want to join our conversation, post questions to our commentators today, Chris Lehane, Mark Baerbach, and John Fortier. Here's the number if you want to join us, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments online. Back in just a moment, this is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the election coming up on November the 2nd, just 4 days from now. We're doing a wrap-up of where things stand, where they may go over the next 4 days, and what's likely to happen in the aftermath. Our guests include Chris Lehane, Democratic consultant and partner at Fabiani and Lehane, Mark Baerbach, national political correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and John Fortier, research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. We welcome your calls and participation in our conversation. Here again, the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments online. We'll start with your calls and emails in just a moment. Before we do, though, I'm just curious to get your take, each of you, on this new kind of candidate we've seen this year, the Joe Millers of Alaska, Sharon Angle in Nevada, Christine O'Donnell in Delaware. And the fascinating thing from the New York Times poll, Mark Baerbach, which showed that 57% of those polled said they would be willing to take a chance on candidates without experience. Have you been picking up on that as well? What does that say to you?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've picked up on that, but I've gotten two different takes on that, and I think it's somewhat revealing. I mean, yes, I've done a lot of interviewing in Nevada, where you can't find a better place to find anger at the establishment, and there is a lot of that let's try an outsider sentiment, but you don't hear that so much here in California. I did a piece a week or so ago. I went down to San Benito, which, you know, if you don't want to look at my story, look at the statistics. They have this uncanny history going back to 94 of matching, not just picking the winner, but coming within fractions of a percentage point of matching the statewide vote. So it's a terrific bellwether. And I went down there, and the thing that struck me over and over was hearing people saying, you know what, we tried this outsider thing. It didn't work so good with Arnold again. I'm not making any predictions, but it's very interesting because it's almost like we in California had our Tea Party back in 2003, and people here aren't as enamored of the idea. And again, I'm not casting aspersions on any of the Tea Party candidates, saying what or won't happen, but it is striking the difference between what people in California have said about this versus other places.
It is really interesting, Chris Lehane, as Mark suggests, perhaps California's already had its Tea Party moment. But when you look at the races for both Senate and governor, you could not describe really two more inside political candidates who at this point appear to be pointed towards victory than Barbara Boxer and Jerry Brown.
Yeah, and look, I think there's a couple reasons about why, you know, they're as well positioned as they are based on the public polling. You know, I think, first of all, while they are quote-unquote career politicians, they've also been historically not really necessarily marching in tune with the establishment. I mean, these have been politicians, but they've also been historically anti-establishment types. I mean, both of them over the course of their career and how they've comported themselves. I think secondly, they're running against people who are sort of by, for, and almost symbols of corporate America. I mean, you have Queen Meg out of eBay, and you have, you know, Corporate Carly out of HP. And in an era where people are upset and anxious, being a career politician is the scarlet letter. Coming out of corporate America, I think, is an obscene word in this election. And then the third piece, at the end of the day, this still is a Democratic state, you know, where there's going to be somewhere between a low of 7 and a high of 11 or 12 turnout advantage for Democrats. And that ultimately does play itself out.
John Fortier, from your seat in Washington, D.C., are people looking west and scratching their heads and saying, Jerry Brown?
Well, I would look at California and say, it's been an incredible run of now almost 10 years where almost every seat is in the hands of the party it was planned to be in the last redistricting, which is which safely put lots of Democrats in seats and safely put Republicans. Only one seat, the McInerney seat, which might switch back, has really deviated from that pattern. So one, you have some very, very safe seats. And I think, as Chris mentioned, you have a Democratic state where you are seeing, you know, the populism and the ability of new candidates to come out of nowhere in districts is in Republican and swing states. Republicans are going to gain a lot of seats, but they're not going to gain a whole lot of seats in places that are pretty Democratic. And I give Democrats some credit for doing the opposite in 2006, 2008. Rahm Emanuel recruiting some very strong conservative Democrats who could win in places like Indiana and Idaho. There are very, very few places where Republicans are going to win that are, you know, significantly on the Democratic side. Illinois, maybe. That's a special case, and certainly not a Tea Party candidate with Mark Kirk, more of a moderate Republican. And I would have thought with Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina, in some ways, yes, they're corporate, but in many ways, the best you could do is Republicans. They're women CEOs who've accomplished people who are self-funders. Those are pretty good profiles for California, and yet Republicans can't win in what is a very Democratic state.
Let's hear what our listeners are thinking about as we approach Election Eve. Colin starts us out in San Francisco. Colin, go ahead.
Good morning. I actually cast my ballot by absentee vote for third-party candidates for governor and Senate. My rationale for doing so was largely because the polling data showed that Brown and Boxer were going to win anyway. I am very strongly in favor of same-sex marriage, also pro-choice, but I didn't feel like supporting the Democratic major candidates this year. Part of the reason was I wanted to cast a protest vote against the Obama administration's having decided to appeal the federal court decision striking down DOMA and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I'm wondering if maybe there are going to be a lot of other voters like myself who will be here next week.
Colin, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Mark, give me your sense of that. Lots been written in recent days that, that part of the problem Democrats have is some of what Colin is suggesting, that that they have not been liberal enough, that they've been too timid in what they've put forward, the sort of John Stewart kind of approach as came through in the interview with President Obama the other night. What's your sense? Are you picking up on that?
Well, a couple of things. I think that there is some of that. I think that there are, you know, that's a problem that some Democrats have with the president, that he hasn't been more ambitious, that he hasn't done more. I mean, I think it's very interesting. People tend to look at polls that show opposition to the health care measure and assume that that's people don't like it because intrusiveness, et cetera, but if you look within the numbers, a large segment of people don't like the health care bill because they think it could have gone even further. So there's definitely that upset within the Democratic Party, within the base. I think, you know, when Colin was talking, it reminds me, it was almost a Yogi Berra-ism. I go back to the 2002 governor's race, which you'll recall Gray Davis, you know, won by a surprising narrow 45-41, and I think the only reason it was so close is because it was a blowout. I think a lot of people said, you know, he's going to win anyway, so I'm going to vote for a third party or whatever, and that's why Gray Davis ended up getting 45. So I think Colin illustrates that. You know, he's going to win anyway, so hey, I'm going to vote for somebody else.
Does that make you nervous, Chris Lehane, when you hear the Collins of the world?
Whenever I hear that, I immediately think of Ralph Nader in 2000. I mean, look, I appreciate the call and I appreciate the sentiments, but as a Democrat, you know, having seen what happened in 2000 when folks in Florida, Oregon, Washington State, a number of other places, took the same tact, which made the election much closer and in many levels, you know, produced George W. Bush and 8 years of Bush. So just picking up on some of what Dr. Baraback said, I do think that if some Democrats are thinking that way out there, I would implore them and plead for them to try to stick with the party. Having said all that, I think the caller does hit on, you know, the point that we've been discussing here, which is, you know, I think there were enormously high, I mean, artificially high expectations for the president when he came in. He ran on a concept of hope, which wasn't necessarily a vision of where he was going to take the country, but sort of an amorphous concept. And once you become a president, once you actually have the responsibility, you needed to translate that into some type of vision of where you're going to take the country. Otherwise, you end up on sort of this y-axis where every day you make a decision. Sometimes you make a decision and the moderates think you sold them out. Sometimes you make a decision and the progressives think you sold them out, as opposed to having a message that allows you to transcend that and bring everyone in. I think that ultimately comes back to one of the central challenges. And again, he's dealing with a really, really, really hard economy. I mean, a good economy, this is a very different conversation.
John 48, let me ask you about something else that Colin's question brings up, which is that he's already voted and the whole vote by mail phenomenon changes not only, of course, the dynamics of the election, but sometimes it even makes things like debates irrelevant because people have already voted before the debates even take place. As a political scientist, is this something that concerns you, the overall drift in that direction in American democracy?
It does. I actually wrote a book about this in 2006, which you haven't heard of because it's not the sexiest topic in the world, but now is on people's mind. And I do have some worries. I know you're in California, and my worries are especially about voting by mail. I'm a little less worried about states that open up their polling places early. But look, both things are happening. We're doing a lot more voting early, and one of the concerns is, yes, that important information occurs, and then people have already voted. Another famous case, of course, with California was with the John Edwards campaign in a primary where it can be even more extreme, that the candidate you voted for is no longer in the race when Election Day rolls around. So all that being said, still most people vote the week before the election, those who vote early. Campaigns are having to adjust their turnout strategies and when they go negative. But I think there's a little bit of overstatement or trying to read the tea leaves too much on this. There are a number of people looking around the country saying, well, look, early voting is up for Democrats in Iowa. That's a good sign for them. I think overall what we'll see is Republican enthusiasm is pretty consistent across the country that'll do better in Republican areas. And it's an interesting phenomenon, one that has many implications for us, but probably isn't a sign that that one party is really doing better than the other. The whole of the electorate is what counts, and we'll know that by election day.
I want to get back to our calls, Chris, but you wanted to add in something quickly.
First, I'd love to see John's book, because at an operational level, particularly out in California, how these campaigns are run has completely changed. You effectively have 30 days of an election. And just to give some sense of the numbers, in the first 7 to 10 days of early voting in California, which would have begun October 4th this year, you did have somewhere between 20 and 25% of the total electorate actually vote. By the time you get to election day, it will be around 50%. But a quarter of the electorate took place in that first week of October, and that really impacts campaign advertising, campaign spending, messages. And so these campaigns are changing pretty fundamentally in terms of how you run them.
And to Stephen in San Anselmo.
Yes, hello there. Thanks, gentlemen, for taking my call.
You bet.
I'd appreciate your panel's feedback on what might be called the silver lining scenario for the Democrats. It appears for most of the predictions I've read that the largest percentage of Democrats who will probably lose their seats in this election cycle will be the more conservative Democrats, the blue dogs, which the result would be more progressive or more traditional Democrats holding on to their seats, and thus a more, more traditional Democratic backbone being expressed in terms of their actions in Congress. What do you think about that?
Stephen, thanks. John Forte, you want to chime in?
Sure. No, I think there is some truth to what the caller is saying about the result that will happen. In one way, I think we may look at the election results and say, look, it doesn't look so different than it did after the 2004 election. Republicans have gotten back a majority in the House. Their numbers are not so different than they were then. But if you look underneath that, in 2006 and 2008, an awful lot of Republican moderates were knocked out in the Northeast and replaced by Democrats. And the seats that Republicans are going to take back, there'll be some swing districts, but a lot of them are pretty Republican seats. And we may have even more polarization than we had before. It's a trend that we've had for the last 30, 35 years of the parties becoming more clearly left and clearly right. But I think we're going to see that to another extreme. There will be very, very few people in the middle on both sides after this election.
Damian writes in, I want to offer another way of interpreting the 57% who are willing to try inexperienced candidates. If I think the federal government overreaches frequently and what they actually pass is not good for the country, then I might prefer someone who has no experience in this. Furthermore, if the important issues they must decide, there are many staffers, etc., who can help them sort that out. So if I were dissatisfied with Congress, why would I want someone experienced with the previous process that took place there? And Andrew in Mountain View writes, Mark Baerbach said that there's been a large expansion of the federal government under Obama, but despite the popular belief, that isn't really true. There are no large federal programs. A big percentage of the Stimulus Act was actually tax cuts, not new spending, and it now appears that the government will get back much of the money it spent on bailing out various financial institutions. Healthcare reform didn't create a new bureaucracy or add many federal employees, but overall, Mark, that's certainly not really the sense you get, and it would be hard to argue that President Obama has not been an activist president.
No, and I'm not an expert in terms of the levels of staffing. I'd have to go to OMB or whatever to get that sort of stuff. I don't live and breathe inside the Beltway, but I think most people would agree that certainly the scope of the federal government. I mean, look, we the American people, the taxpayers, now own GM and Chrysler. I mean, the federal government, I think a few would argue, has at least, if not in the number of employees, certainly expanded its scope and its oversight and involvement in the economy and the market and those sorts of things.
Some other comments coming in. Amy writes in, I'm appalled that someone would vote against his own best interests to seemingly spite a party that is actually working for its goals. If Colin and people like him, that's the person who called in earlier saying he was voting on a third party ticket, Colin and people like him vote Republican to make a statement against slow moving progress, they'll deserve the regression that we have to endure if Republicans win. And this comment from Sarah, the two biggest things that drive my husband and me crazy is the Obama's administration's failure to communicate their successes, preserving the auto industry, providing guaranteed health care, and so forth. Do you agree with that, Chris, that they have not done a good job of communicating what they have established?
Yeah. I mean, look, the president himself has acknowledged some of this in some recent interviews. To me, it's a little bit less than a communications challenge or a PR challenge. You know, it does come back to giving a broader sense of where you're taking the country. And if you think about historically great presidents, you know, they've had a very simple vision that connected with folks, that reflected a philosophy in terms of government. And it also had a dialectical aspect to it, meaning that they were standing up for the American people against some external or internal threat. And, you know, it seems to me that it's a very obvious issue out there, which is who's going to win the jobs of the 21st century? Who's going to protect the American dream? And I think, in fact, the president has done a lot of policies that, in fact, do exactly that. I'm just not sure it has really been encapsulated in a broader vision that is bringing the country along. And again, and I hate to keep pushing this, but, you know, he is dealing with an extremely difficult economy and challenging times. This was going to be a tough election under any circumstances. Do I think we could, from a Democratic perspective, we could be slightly better off providing people a larger vision, a theory of the case? Yes.
And to Dean next in Oakland. Dean, go ahead.
Hi. Question and comment. My question is, how many votes in the Senate do the Republicans have to pick up? Assuming they win the House, how many votes in the Senate do they have to pick up in order to pass through bills, shove through bills, and perhaps repeal the health care bill? And my comment is this. I'm going to vote for a third-party candidate because for the last 40 years I voted for the lesser of the evils, I don't like where the country is. The fact is that I agree that the Republicans and the Democrats have worked hard to exclude third-party possibilities. And so I'm going to vote for a third party for that reason.
And just out of curiosity, if you don't mind saying, Dean, what third party draws you?
Well, I don't agree with a bunch of the stuff that the third parties offer either, but I think I'm going to go green this time.
Okay, Dean, thanks for the call and the observation. To Dean's specific question, John Fortier, about what would it take to repeal health care, thoughts?
Well, he asked about the numbers. I mean, technically, the Republicans are going to need 10 seats just to take the majority. I suppose if you wanted to have a filibuster-proof majority, you'd need 19, and then you'd need two-thirds to override a presidential veto. So that none of those three cases are likely to happen, and certainly the last two are certainly not going to happen. But, you know, I do think, you know, we'll see opportunities that Republicans take to try to make some statements about health care. They may have the House and be able to pass bills knocking at parts of it, knocking at the individual mandate, maybe knocking at the subsidies, or just putting things on the table for the 2012 election. Yeah, I do also think you'll see some Republican governors dragging their feet on implementing some of these things. So there will be ways in which Republicans will oppose it, but I don't think that there's any chance of Republicans all in one swoop repealing it. And even if they were to take the presidency of majorities, you know, I think it's probably more likely that they would move to cut back on a fair amount of it rather than, you know, taking the whole thing back as a whole.
And to Jeff in Menlo Park. Jeff, you're on.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm no longer. I used to be a staunch Republican, and then I since voted Democrat this last election. But now I'm to the point where I no longer have a party affiliation. I'm trying to vote with who I think might do the best job, who might represent their constituency the best. And right now, I believe everybody that's in these offices are a bunch of self-serving, treasonous. I can't say the next word.
Jeff, you're breaking up a little bit on us, but I think we got in your last sentence the level of dissatisfaction that you feel. Thanks for the comment and observation. Mark, ring true to you in terms of what you've heard around the country?
In terms of people being ticked off, yeah. And in terms of looking at alternatives and not being happy, yeah. Again, this feeling that there are big problems. And, here in California, for example, talking about, you know, who used what epithet to describe Meg Whitman and who did or didn't have an illegal maid. And, you know, in Delaware, it's witches this and bearded Marxist that and all this goofy stuff. And the bottom line is, you know, people in the political press like to write about it and consultants, we all enjoy chattering about it. But, you know, if you talk to people, what I call real people, to them, they're like, is like bread and circuses. It's like, what does this have to do with me?
Well, it's a really important point, and I'm glad you brought it up, Mark Baribeck, and it speaks to our collective role in the media and in journalism, to what we pay attention to. I think you could make the point, Chris Lehane, that in the gubernatorial race, the three things that have gotten the most attention have been Meg Whitman's housekeeper, Jerry Brown's aide's comment about Meg Whitman, and this last sort of faux controversy over negative ads, none of which are things that people in California really care about.
I will just depart a little bit from this, because I disagree about this analysis at some level, which is I do think ultimately most of these campaigns, particularly competitive campaigns, do come down to character tests, how people feel about the different candidates, which ones they relate to more, who do they trust more. And so a number of these issues blow up because they really become signifiers for character. They tell voters something deeper about the core of the person. And so the nanny gate issue for Meg Whitman was a very debilitating issue, not only because of the underlying sort of substantive policy nature of it being inconsistent with what she had said in the past, but because it raised issues about trust, it raised issues about hypocrisy, and then she really mishandled it. I mean, one of the things that happened in campaigns is, and I've seen this from time and time again in competitive races, voters look to see how a candidate handles a challenging issue, and they extrapolate an awful lot about that. And so I do think these issues are really – I do think they go to deeper issues than necessarily just the bread and circus aspect that Mark addressed.
Yeah, fair point. But I guess, John Fortier, what I'm getting or wondering about in this is, even if you accept Chris's analysis that they're revealing in some way about who someone truly is – I think it'd be hard to make the argument right now that people in our state or anywhere else across the country necessarily know what Jerry Brown's, you know, education plan is, or Meg Whitman's plan on how to create jobs. Instead, they know about Nannygate.
Well, in some ways, it is unfortunately true that we cover a lot of those things. But this is an election that does have a certain direction and a narrative, and it may not be that way in every election, certainly for Republicans. But I think that they feel that they have a big narrative, a big simple narrative. The president and Democrats have done too much. We're moving towards, you know, larger government, more debts and deficits and taxes, and we're very unhappy about the economy in general, and we want to, you know, send a message. So I think that message gets through, and that is a kind of political difference between the parties. And yes, there's a lot of sideshow stuff, especially I think on the Republican side. Many of the challengers are new figures, and we are learning things about them. Some of them quite shocking. Whereas more established incumbents, all these things have come out. So it's not at a very detailed level, yes, but especially a wave election does have a kind of narrative to it, and I think this one does. And it may not play out as much in California, a Democratic state, but it certainly is going to play out in a number of states across the country.
Brian in Sacramento has a comment to offer. Brian, go ahead.
Hi, yes. So my question is basically, when we founded this country, the Framing Fathers, they implemented these plans and these ideas, but they didn't foresee the country being as big as it is now, like with free market and the Electoral College voting system. Do you guys feel that the Electoral College system is still working? Because I know I've talked to a few people in like my political science classes, and they always say, like, if it's not broken, don't fix it. But do you feel that it is still working in the same way that they had planned on it working for us?
Brian, thanks. Thanks for the question. Mark, if you would, why don't you respond not only in terms of the question about the Electoral College, but it raises these other issues I think that Brian is getting at about, among the Tea Party group in particular, this question of direct election of senators and various things that they'd like to get the country back to.
Well, a couple things. First of all, in the Electoral College, I mean, is it working the way they envisioned? One of the premises behind the Electoral College was to give small states a proportional, not a proportional, but a fair share opportunity to voice their opinions. I mean, look, if it was just a popular vote, Democratic candidates could camp out in California and New York and a few other blue states and just run up the total. And I'm not defending or I'm not going to take a position if the Electoral College is good or not, but the idea behind it is that candidates have to campaign everywhere for support. And so to that extent, is it working? I guess you could say it is. You know, the other thing on the Constitution is very interesting because, you know, a lot of people in the Tea Party have sort of embraced the Founding Fathers and sort of this, I would say, if not simplistic, certainly narrow view of what it is that founding fathers envisioned. And if you go back, and I'm not going to try and come across as a lot smarter than I am, but if you look at the Federalist Papers and you go back and you read that period, there were very, very vigorous debates. I mean, James Madison, Hamilton, people who were pushing for a very, very large, very activist federal government, a federal government that even had veto power over state legislation, which we don't have today. So, you know, it's almost like, you know, the Bible. You can go in the Federalist Papers, you can look back at our history and pick any part you want and say that's the chosen truth. But the fact is, the Founding Fathers had a lot of debates, which we're continuing to have today, about whether the federal government should be big or little, about whether states should be able to nullify federal laws or not. I mean, none of this is new.
And one more quick call from Casey, who joins us from Virginia, a state we're all going to be watching on election night. Casey, just a quick comment, please, because we're short on time.
Okay, I was just saying that I am against the Tea Party because I view them as really no more than a fringe element of the Republican Party, the Republicans in different clothing, if you will. I'm a staunch supporter of separation of church and state, and I don't want to have their views and morality legislated to me through the government. They don't stand up and say that they want to have less government, but in my view and in my what I'm hearing from them is that they want to have laws enacted to put forth their religious beliefs.
Casey, thanks. Thanks for the observation. Just a quick thought on that as we conclude, John Fortier and then Chris Lehane, on the whole Tea Party phenomenon, which has probably in many ways been the most interesting element of campaign 2010.
Well, the Tea Party may end up being a double-edged sword for Republicans down the road. And in this election, it's been a big plus for them in terms of energy. And also, I in some ways disagree with the caller. It's true that some of them are quite conservative on social issues, but it really is about economics and the size of government. And that's, even though maybe not in the extreme form of the Tea Party, that's something that unites a lot of other Republicans, moderates, and independents. So I think it's a good thing this year in the future when there's a coalition of other Republicans and Tea Partiers and when there might be a Republican president and trying to put that all together as a governing coalition, that might be more difficult. But for this election, it's been a general positive for Republicans.
And, Crick, just a very quick thought on that. In some ways, that's President Obama's challenge in some ways, is to connect with people who have the concerns that the Tea Party does.
Yeah, at some level, the Tea Party certainly is an epiphenomenon, a byproduct of the enormous anxiety that exists out there, and particularly about the direction of the country and the structural challenges that we face. And you can slice and dice the Tea Party. You can talk about the fact a lot of its funding comes from the Koch brothers, you know, a deep pocket of Republican financial interest. The interesting element to watch on the Tea Party will be whether the sort of red state Bolshevik versus red state Menshevik fratricide that took place in their primary manifests itself in leadership fights if they happen to take back the House. And if it does, you're going to see those fights. It's going to be a bloodbath in the House within hours of the election being over.
We'll see what happens next. Chris Lehane, Mark Baerbeck, John Fortier, thanks all very much for being part of our program this morning. Thanks to our listeners for their calls and emails as well. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Howard Gelman is our engineer today. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.